Yeah, it has been it's been 24 sermons since we started this series on Leviticus. And I hope that you have enjoyed these messages as much as I've enjoyed them. I mentioned this before, I put off preaching Leviticus for a long time. I don't know why, but years ago, Jaquel, my daughter, had said, you should preach Leviticus. And I don't know why, but I just put it off for a long time. I think it's because, you know, people have a difficulty with this book, which is probably a reason why I should have preached it sooner. Anyway, I am very glad that I've preached through Leviticus. Today will be, as I mentioned in the email, the 21st book of the Bible that I have preached here, which I think is a pretty significant feat. All glory be to God, of course, but it's an exciting day, I think, in the life of the church as this happens. As I have preached through Leviticus, and as I've talked with many of you about this series and about what we've learned, what has become clear to me is that what we find here in this book of the Bible that sometimes puzzles us is a strong foundation for understanding the gospel. Strong foundation for understanding the gospel. So we got into this book and went through chapters 1 through 7, which was a bit difficult for some. I did hear comments about that at the beginning. So much talk about blood week in and week out. Yet in those studies, we considered the sacrificial system and we realized our need for atonement, that we need the relationship between us and God repaired. And so Leviticus, in fact, takes us back to the very beginning of the Bible, where we learn about the fall of mankind and the sin which needs dealt with if we are to be restored to that right relationship. We then moved into chapters 8 through 10, and in chapters 8 through 10, we learned about the priesthood and about the fact that not only do we need our sin dealt with, but we need a mediator between us and God, which is how the priests functioned. They served in between as a intercessor between Israel and God. And so we also need someone to stand in the gap between us and God. And then we got into chapters 11 through 16, and there we learned about the need for purity in worship. And then we got to chapter 17 through 26, and we learned about how we must live as God's people, which is to say we must be holy as God is holy. Which brings us to today, to our last sermon on Leviticus, which is sermon 25. And that's pretty good, because if you recall, I had planned to spend half a year in Leviticus, which means I'm just one sermon short of half a year, and I will take it. So here we are at Leviticus chapter 27. It is a long chapter. I'm not going to read the entire chapter. What we find here is what some have called an appendix to the book. Do you know what an appendix is? I love reading, as you all know, and I suspect what you think of when you hear appendix, what I hear from most people is that it's something that's at the end of the book. But it doesn't really matter. You know, you can just skip over it. You can ignore it. And in fact, the definition of appendix supports this understanding. So if that's what you've thought, then you're correct. The definition is that an appendix is a section at the end of a book, thesis, dissertation, or report, where the author places extra material that supports the main text but isn't essential to understanding it directly. Now, I'm going to tell you what I've told everybody when it comes to reading a book. And that is that when you read a book, you should read the front matter, like the preface and introduction. Don't just skip through to chapter one. And you should also read the end matter, if there's an epilogue or there are appendices. Now, this is even more important, of course, if this appendix that we find is in the Bible, because if it is an appendix, then it is inspired equally as much as the rest of the book. Which is to say, it's as much the Word of God in Leviticus 27 as in Leviticus 1 through 26. But there's something else that must be mentioned here, and that is the reason that some believe that this is an appendix. This is it. They believe this is an appendix because the book of Leviticus would end better at chapter 26. Because in chapter 26, as we studied the last 2 weeks, we find the curses and the blessings that go along with the covenant. And so they look and they say that would be a much more appropriate ending, which means that chapter 27 must be an appendix that was added on, which indicates here that this really isn't an appendix at all. It's simply the last chapter of Leviticus 27 because God thought it was a good way to end the book. And if God thinks it's a good way to end Leviticus, then so too should we. So after including the blessings and curses in chapter 25, which in essence are what God vows to do if they obey or disobey, we find a chapter about Israel's vows that they make to God. And it's split up into three sections. So section 1, verses 1 through 13, addresses vows made concerning humans and animals, and we'll talk about what that is. And then section 2, verses 14 through 24, addresses dedications, which are very similar to vows, but they concern inanimate objects like houses and land. And then section 3 basically has some miscellaneous instructions concerning vows and dedications and a few other things. So without further ado, with that introduction, let's get into this last chapter of Leviticus, where we are going to discover three very important things. And the three things that I pray that we will discover are, number one, that our words matter, and we should say as we do. And we should do as we say. Number two, that we should give to the church. And the reason that we should give to the church is because of the priority of worship. And number three, that we should do what God says, because this is what he has redeemed and set us apart for. So let's get into this very interesting chapter. And the first section, as I said, deals with vows concerning animate objects, so people or animals. So making a vow, it could just include vowing to do something. So I'm sure some of you have heard of the Nazirite vow. And the Nazirite vow was simply a vow of your commitment to God in specific ways. You can read about that in Numbers 6, 2. It's you making a vow that you will live in a particular way. But making a vow could also include vowing to do something if God answers your prayer in a particular way. So there's an if and a then to many vows. Like, for example, with Jephthah, who, as we read, made a vow to Yahweh, and he said, if you will give the Ammonites into my hand, then whatever comes out from the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the Ammonites shall be Yahweh's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering. Jephthah's vow, very interesting. I very much would love to get into that this morning, but I just bring it up to illustrate this point that a vow can include an if-then element. Maybe let's look at a good vow instead of Jephthah's vow, which was clearly a bad vow, a vow he shouldn't have made and a vow he shouldn't have kept. I said I wasn't going to get into it. Let's move from Jephthah. We can talk about Jephthah some other time. Let's consider a good vow, like with Hannah. Right? Hannah, she pled with God for a son. And we read in 1 Samuel 1, verse 11, she vowed a vow and she said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant and remember me and not forget your servant, but will give to your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life and no razor shall touch his head. So that was a vow that Hannah made. Hannah didn't have to make that vow. That vow was a voluntary vow that she was permitted to make. But because she made it, she should keep it. And she did keep it. We read in 1 Samuel 1:24, when Hannah had weaned him, she took him up with her, along with a three-year-old bull, an ephah of flour and a skin of wine, and she brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh, and the child was young. Then they slaughtered the bull, and they brought the child to Eli, and she said, O my Lord, as you live, my Lord, I am the woman who is standing here in your presence praying to the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition that I made to him. Therefore, I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is lent to the Lord. And he worshiped the Lord there. So it's important to realize Hannah's not making a deal with God here. You know, that's not what is happening here. This was an appropriate vow to make, a vow that God permitted her to make, a vow that she did make. And as she made this vow, she recognized God's sovereignty and authority over all things. In other words, if she received a son, she recognized that that son was from God. It was also a way of acknowledging that if she did receive what she asked for, this was a demonstration of God's grace and kindness towards her. And finally, it was a way of saying that all she has, including if she has a son, belongs to God. So Hannah made a vow which concerned a person, her son, and she kept the vow. And that was right. If you make a vow, you should keep that vow. But here in our text for today, we find that there was an allowance in some cases, or as it says, when someone made a special vow. So this is not just your regular run-of-the-mill vow. This is a special vow, and there were these occasions where you received an option to redeem the person whom you vowed. So you could pay an amount of money to the tabernacle, and this would set the person free from the vow that was made. This is something that Hannah could have done. Imagine her son is born, and she looks in the eyes of that boy, and she just says, I can't. I mean, imagine what it was like for her to go and drop her son off at the tabernacle, and then to go each year and bring him a little coat. So sweet, right? A little detail that the scripture includes. And she looks and she says, I can't do it. Well, she could have made a payment to the tabernacle and have redeemed the life of Samuel. Now, what she did was right. She should have kept the vow. But she there were allowances here. So we learn about these in verses 1 through 8. As you see in verses 3 through 7, if you read through this before this morning, which I hope you did, you find kind of a redemption price list. So it's important that we recognize what this price list was based upon, right? Because there's different prices depending on whether it's a male or female and whether or not they're young or they're old. I'm not going to go through each of them, but, you know, we do have to recognize that these are not distinctions made based upon intrinsic value, as though an able-bodied young man is of more value to God than a precious little child or a senior citizen. That's not what's going on here. All people are created in the image of God, and so all people have equal intrinsic value. The distinction, I think, is based upon performance ability, which is to say, if you were to employ a young man, he would be worth more because he could do more than an older woman or a young child. And the value of redeeming a person who was vowed to service in the tabernacle was based on this, so that the lowest valuation was for an infant, 5 shekels for a male or 3 for a female. And the highest was for an adult between the ages of 20 and 60, 50 shekels for a male and 30 for a female. Now, if you have issues with this distinction between male and females, problem with this distinction is only 40 or 50 years old. For the majority of history, humanity has recognized that males and females are different. And in general, there are jobs that males are suited for that women are not suited for, and vice versa for that matter. And so this distinction recognizes that there's a difference between young and old and male and female. With that said, you know, as I said, I'm not going to go through all of the prices. You can go through those if you like sometime. If somebody wanted to redeem somebody that they had vowed, and they couldn't afford what this price list dictated, the priest could then adjust the redemption price, which is an extreme demonstration of God's grace. Not only that he allowed you to redeem somebody that you vowed that you ought not to have or that you changed your mind about, but if you couldn't afford to redeem them, then the priest could, he had the ability to change the price so you could afford it. That's people. But then in verses 9 through 13, we learn that you could also redeem an animal that you had vowed to sacrifice to the Lord, but only if it was of the unclean variety. So if you vowed an animal that was to be used as an offering, which would be a clean animal, you could not redeem it. And if you tried to be a sneak and come in and replace the animal with a different animal, then you had to give the animal that you redeemed and you had to give the animal that you tried to swap it out for. We see this in verses 9 and 10. You could vow an unclean animal to the tabernacle. This was an animal that couldn't be offered as a sacrifice, but it could be used some other way or sold for profits. You could redeem it, but you had to buy it back, and this is going to become a theme, for whatever it was valued at, plus 20%. So that's what we learn in verses 1 through 13, which, you know, provides an interesting opportunity for us here as we consider application. What does this mean for us who don't take part in this vow and redemption system? Well, I think there's two things that apply to us today. The first is that this system, as I said, demonstrates the grace of God, that he allowed the Israelites to make right on a rash vow without suffering the full consequences of that vow. You know, God didn't need to provide this for them. God didn't need to include Leviticus 27, right? It's not an appendix. It is the word of God, but we should recognize this, that God didn't need to do this. He could have said, you make a vow, tough luck. You keep the vow. But no, he demonstrates his grace by setting up this system so that they could make right on their vows. And he did this because he loves his people, and he understands that they are often fickle and they often make bad decisions. Amen? We often make bad decisions, don't we? And God provides a system whereby they can make up for their bad decisions. But we do need to realize that there were still consequences. So you did receive the person you vowed back, but you still had to pay a price. And so the application I want to make this morning is that you should be very careful about what you say. I don't expect any of you to, you know, make vows or dedications like we see here in Scripture. But the lesson we learn here is that they should have been very careful about the vows that they made. Jephthah should have been much more careful about the vow that he made. If the story of Jephthah teaches us anything, it is that. Be careful what you say when you make a vow. But for us, we should be careful about what we say, whether it's a vow or not. This is why Moses told the heads of the tribes of Israel in Numbers 30, verse 2, if a man vows a vow to the Lord, or swears an oath to bind himself by a pledge, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. In other words, you're better off not making a vow if there's a chance that you might not keep your vow, which is why Jesus says, do not take an oath at all. Let what you say simply be yes or no. Now, I've mentioned this many times, but it does need mentioning again here. Jesus is not condemning making vows or taking oaths. He allows for vows to be made. Because before what he says in Numbers 30, verse 2, where it says, if a man vows to a vow to the Lord, we read, this is what the Lord has commanded. The Lord commanded, if a man vows a vow to the Lord, he should keep the vow, which means that God allows for vows. So Jesus is not condemning vows here. What he's saying is that it's not only when we make a vow that what we say matters, but everything that we say matters. Everything that we say matters. And so when you say you're going to do something, you should do what you say you will do. You might recall in Pastor Jake's last sermon from James, he addressed Jesus' words about oaths because James refers to them in chapter 5, verse 12. And in that sermon, Jake made the same point I am making here, which is to say whether we are signing a mortgage or promising to help a friend move, we should do what we say regardless of the cost. If we say we're going to do it, we should do it. Whether it's the law in Leviticus that we look to, or the words of Jesus that we look to, or the letter of James, the point is the same. Do what you say you will do. And as Pastor Jake pointed out so well, that means you must be careful about what you say. And instead of being quick to speak, right, we should be slow to speak. Slow to speak, something that we learn with time, don't we? All right, so for the young people here, learn from us older people's bad examples and be slow to to speak. Be careful what you say you will do, and do what you say that you will do. Moving on to verses 14 through 24. We start with vows concerning animate objects, and we move to dedications concerning inanimate objects. As far as the difference between a dedication and a vow, what's a dedication and what's a vow? They are quite similar, but a dedication doesn't necessarily need to include a vow. It could. In Proverbs, we read that it is a snare to say rashly, it is holy. That's to dedicate something, and to reflect only after making vows. So a dedication can be connected with a vow, but it doesn't need to. You could just declare an object holy, which is say you could just dedicate an object to the tabernacle, or you could make a vow that you will dedicate it if God grants some particular request. The first object that is addressed in our text is one of the more significant objects a person owns, that is a house. As far as the instructions for redemption, it's simple. If you dedicate your house to the Lord, you sign. This is to say you sign its ownership over to the tabernacle. You no longer own it. The tabernacle owns it. You put it now in the care of the priests. If you do this, you can then redeem it. If you decide, nope, I think I changed my mind. I think I want to redeem it. I want ownership back. You could buy it back, and you would go and you would pay the price that you received for it. But you would also have to pay 20%. I told you, it's going to be a theme, 20% what it was valued at. So there was a cost there. You could say, ooh, I made a mistake. I shouldn't have dedicated my house. And they would say, very well, God is gracious. You can redeem it, but 20% more. Now, when it comes to land, it gets a little bit trickier when you dedicate land to the Lord. And it's because of the year of Jubilee. So there's two situations addressed here. And if you recall, the year of Jubilee is when everything that had changed ownership went back to its original owner. So when it came to land, there was two situations. One, if you dedicated part of the land that you owned. And the second was if you dedicated land that you leased from someone else. So when it comes to your own land, if you want to dedicate it, the valuation was set depending on what it would cost to seed it. We see this in verse 16. And also when the year of Jubilee fell. Okay, so you give a parcel of land, you dedicate it to the Lord, it now becomes the tabernacles, and you say, I want to buy it back. Well, you know, you got to consider the cost of what it was to seed the land, right? Because they've gone and seeded it. Now you need to cover that cost. And, you know, in other words, what they don't want happening is somebody say, oh, I'm going to dedicate this land to the tabernacle. And the priests go, woohoo, and they seed the land. And then the guy's, no, I changed my mind. I want it back. And now he's benefited from that. So it's based on what it costs to seed it, but it also based on when the next Jubilee year fell, because at that time it would go back to its original owner. So you could redeem it. You could buy that piece of land back, but guess what? How much you had to pay on top of the cost of the land? 20%. One-fifth. Now, if you did not redeem a piece of land that you dedicated to the Lord before the Jubilee, or if you leased out a piece of land that you had dedicated to the Lord, you wouldn't get it back. It would remain in the ownership of the tabernacle. We see this in verses 20 and 21. Once again, we come to a unique situation. What does this mean for us? Well, I think that the application for us this morning concerns ultimately where our priorities lie. Where do our priorities lie? You see, when it came to objects like lands and houses, you could dedicate such things to the tabernacle, which would demonstrate your concern for the worship of God. Because you might say, why would anybody dedicate something to the tabernacle? Why would they do that? Well, it's because they saw the value of worshiping God. And for the worship of God to continue, guess what? It costs, right? This building doesn't support itself, right? We need to pay to keep things going here. And likewise, though in a different way, for different things, they had to pay to keep the tabernacle running. And so, when you dedicated an object like your house or land, you were showing your concern for the worship of God. You were showing that a priority in your life, you were showing that the priority in your life was that God is worshipped, not just by you, but by all of God's people. So the point here is that your vows or your dedication showed your commitment to worship. And then also, when you redeemed such things according to God's instructions, for whatever reason, you also still contributed to the worship at the tabernacle, didn't you? Because they got their land, like, you know, you give a piece of land and they have to give it back, but they then get 20% more. And so once again, not just in dedicating something to the Lord, but in paying the redemption price, you also show your commitment to the worship of God. Now, we no longer worship at a tabernacle, right? We no longer abide by the vow and redemption rules, but God still makes sure that there is a way that the church and its leaders are provided for, and it's through our offerings, our giving of offerings, which sadly don't really take part in the service. They should. I mean, there is the option there to put it in the box, and, you know, that's good for you if you do. I don't know how we go back from where we've gone, you know, now that we can give our offerings online at home. But I do hope that you never forget that that is an act of worship. And I also hope that you never forget what the motive for giving of your offerings ought to be. It's not because you like me, although I hope you do. You know, it's not because, oh, I must give this. You do not have an obligation. We do not, sometimes you'll hear people refer to tithes and offerings. But people often come to me and say, well, how much do I have to pay? Wrong question, right? Not about how much I have to pay. The question is, how much do I get to pay? And it's not a payment. It's an offering, right? It's an act of worship. But getting back to this, I want you to recognize that the motive for your giving should be the worship of God. The worship of God, that God's people can worship. So that whether, you know, we take the money that was given to the church and we use it, you know, to pay the gas bill, or we use it to pay a plumber to fix a leaky pipe, or we use it to improve the building, or we use it for my monthly support, you know, or we use it for paper towels, or whatever we use it for, it is so that God's people have a place to worship God. And so when you give of your offering and you think, how much should I give? Well, maybe you should think about how much you're committed to the worship of God. I know, that sounds kind of harsh, doesn't it? Because then it's like you think, man, I really should be giving more, which you probably should. I mean, I don't know what anybody gets, just so you know. That information doesn't go past my eyes. I don't want to know. But what we give, and let me also clarify here that I'm not just talking about what we give financially, but what we give in our time, what we give in our talents, you know, talents concerning things that you can do around the building to help it keep running, or whether it concerns your service to the church. All of that, whatever you give, should be motivated by a commitment to worship. So not even like, you know, let's just kind of put aside when it comes to how much you give. Let's not consider that. Let's just consider why you give. Let's not concern ourselves with what you give. Let's consider why you give. You know, don't let it be this, oh yeah, it's time, I got to give my offering. Let it be this, wow, it's this time I get to give my offering. I remember a pastor friend I worked with for a number of years. He used to talk about, I don't even remember where he was. You know what I'm talking about. I don't remember where he was, but he ministered in certain places where people didn't have money to bring, but they'd bring like a chicken, a live chicken or something else. And he would talk about how they would dance down the aisles to put their offerings before the Lord. They were so excited that they had anything to give. I hope that we can adopt that kind of attitude, giving with joyful hearts, considering the fact that God has given to us so that we can give. Ultimately, yes, you're giving to Him, but you're giving because you want to see God worshiped. So just let me, I probably shouldn't have got into the whole thing about how much you give. That's not what I'm concerned about. I am much more concerned about why you give. And so when it comes to giving of your time, your talents, or your treasure, consider why you ought to have a joyful heart. And it's because when you give, you contribute so that God's people can worship God. And if we love God, then we must love what he loves. And he loves the church so much that he sent his son to die for the church. And he is given as head over the church. And as such, our desire must be that God is worshipped according to his word. So what we do with our money, how we spend our time, how we raise our kids, how we live our lives, all of this demonstrates our priorities. And as God's people, our priority must be the worship of God. Right? There's lots of other things that we can get involved in. There's so much I could say about this. You know, there's this idea in the church that our goal is to be culture changers, or to instigate Christian governments. And, you know, it's not to say that there's not something to all of that. But it's only positive in the sense that it contributes to the worship of God. So if we had a Christian government, how much better would that be for us as a church, right? You know, if things in culture changed, which in the States, come on now, they are changing, right? I watched several high government officials preach the gospel to 100,000 people in an arena last Sunday afternoon and to millions more online. Something is going on in America anyway. And come on, that's good. Isn't that good? But only good so much as it contributes to the worship of God. I mean, politics are not unimportant. Our faith should inform our politics. But the desire that we ought to have, I'll just finish this and we'll move on. Our desire must be that God is worshipped. That's it. God is worshipped. That must be our highest priority. Moving on. Verses 25 through 34. I'm going to do a quick bullet point list here of all of these miscellaneous instructions. I'll be as succinct as I can. First instruction in verse 25 concerns how the payments were made. When it came to redeeming something, you had to pay according to the shekel of the sanctuary. The sanctuary determined how much a shekel was worth. A shekel was a unit of weight, and that weight was determined by the tabernacle. It was roughly 11 grams of silver. So each shekel was 11 grams of silver. If there were other places that determined the shekel in a different way, that's fine. But when it came to the shekel of the sanctuary, the priests determined what it was. The second instruction was that you were not allowed to dedicate a firstborn clean animal. And the reason is that the firstborn animals were already to be devoted to the Lord. Moses says in Exodus 13, 1 and 2, consecrate to me all the firstborn, whatever opens a womb among the children of Israel, both man and beast, it is mine. So you can't dedicate something that already is dedicated to God. If a firstborn animal is unclean, which means you can't offer it as sacrifice, you could redeem that firstborn animal if you dedicate it to the Lord, but you have to pay what it's worth plus 20%. Why 20%? I don't know. The next set of instructions concerns a special category, which in Hebrew is herem, and this is translated by the ESV as devoted things. I think it's probably better translated by as the CSB and the NAT translated as something permanently set apart to the Lord, right? If it's permanently set apart, then you can't redeem it. These things that could not be redeemed were things that were permanently devoted to God, and more particularly for destruction. So this would apply to cities and possessions of places God commanded Israel to destroy. You can look up Joshua chapter 6, verse 21 for an example of this. Or possessions of places that Israel vowed to destroy if God gave them victory. You can look up Numbers 21, 2, and 3. In other words, God, you give us victory, we're going to give all the possessions here to you. This would also apply to people who are devoted, individual people devoted to destruction because of egregious sin, like the blasphemer we talked about in Leviticus 24, or an idolater whom God tells Moses to tell Israel that whoever sacrifices to any god other than the Lord alone shall be devoted to destruction. You couldn't redeem that person back. The last set of instructions in verses 30 through 33 concern tithes, which is a tenth of what you have, which again already belonged to God. So when it came to the tithes of your flock, you couldn't redeem that animal. But for some reason, again, I don't know why, God would allow an Israelite to redeem a tithe of his field. So if he gave a tenth of his field, he could buy it back, but he would have to pay an extra 20%. We got it. So, you know, if you have any questions about that quick bullet point, it's okay. If you have any confusion about that, it's okay. Because the last verse of our text makes the particular point that we need to understand here. And this is not just the last verse of our text. This is the last verse of Leviticus. And as we would expect in a book of the Bible, which is filled mostly with law, the last thing he mentions concerns law. And so in verse 34, we read, "These are the commandments that Yahweh commanded Moses for the people of Israel on Mount Sinai." Now, these words apply to chapter 27. I think these words also apply to chapters 1 through 26. You see, when we return to where we began, which is Leviticus chapter 1 and verse 1, this is what we read. "Yahweh called Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting, saying, 'Speak to the people of Israel and say to them.'" And then God goes on to give Israel commands to be obeyed. Commands about worship, commands about living, which means that we should not be surprised that the last word on Leviticus is a reminder that all that they have heard in Leviticus is commanded by God. These were not thought up by Moses. These were not brought together by a council chosen by the people of God. These were commands of God. And this raises a very important application, namely that whenever you hear a call to obedience in this church, either from the pulpit or in a Bible study, whether from me or from Pastor Jake or from one of the other teachers in the church, it is important that you understand that it is only the commands of God that must be obeyed. Not the commands of Sean or the commands of Jake or the commands of Jacob or of Yuri or of Dave or the commands of any other teacher in this church. There are things where there is good instruction to be given based upon, you know, a person's opinion. Like, for example, you know, as I mentioned before, somebody came to me this week and said, "Well, I was thinking about an application for a sermon. Do you think it means this?" And it was a situation where there's not necessarily a yes or no answer. But there are times where, given the fact that myself or one of the other preachers or teachers here has given a lot of time to a subject, you might want to consider their opinion heavily when it comes to an application. But it's very important that we make distinctions between commands and issues of liberty. And so, you know, when I give my opinion, that's what it is, my opinion. It's not to say my opinion doesn't carry weight, but it is just my opinion. And so when it comes to obedience and a call to obedience, it is the commands of God that we seek to obey, not our commands. That's what holiness is about. Holiness is about obedience to the commands of God, not the commands of men. You see, we end our study of Leviticus where we began with this question: how can man fellowship with God? How can a man be in a right relationship with his Creator? And the answer is simple, not complex. Because God is holy. If you want to be in fellowship with God, here it is: you too must be holy. Now, our problem, if we are honest with ourselves, is that we are not holy, are we? We are sinners. So when David asks, "Who can ascend the hill of Yahweh?" the expected answer is not a room full of hands shooting up in the air. The expected answer is not me. I do not have clean hands. I do not have a pure heart. But then that leads us to ask the question, what if there was one who could offer himself as a rightful sacrifice for sinners, something we learned about in Leviticus 1 through 7. What if there was one who was a perfect high priest, one who could stand in the gap, who could serve as a mediator for sinners, like we learned about in chapters 8 through 10 of Leviticus. What if there was one who was perfectly clean, like we learned about in Leviticus 11 through 16, and one who was completely holy, as we learned about in Leviticus 17, verse 26? Well, as we have been reminded week in and week out in our sermon series on Leviticus, there is, and his name is Jesus. He took on flesh. He became a man. He lived a sinless life as a perfect example for us of what holiness looked like so that we could follow his example. And then he suffered and he died in our place by offering himself as a perfect sacrifice. And he did this so that we could be in fellowship with God, so that we could worship him, so that we could be holy and pursue holiness. He then rose from the grave. He ascended to the heavens where he sits at the right hand of the Father right now, interceding for us, keeping us in fellowship with God as our perfect high priest. And it is for this reason that as we leave this sermon series, I am compelled to remind you that the message of Leviticus is, look to Jesus. He is the perfect sacrifice. He is our high priest. He is the one who ascended the hill of the Lord so that through him we could be brought into fellowship with our Creator. Then live like Jesus, which is to say, live a life of holiness by the power of the Holy Spirit as we worship God for his glory.